This is David Burns, and I'm speaking from the Portland, Oregon Marriott Hotel, which is one of the strangest places I've ever been in my life. We have just had a very special and theoretically impossible reunion of the four original members of the Freedom Center. Three of us are sitting here right now. We're sitting in a conference room in the Marriott Hotel, and I feel compelled to begin with paying attention to the ambient sound. And I'm just going to try to connect by singing along with it. Nom, 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 na, da. Very complex sound. It has overtones and undertones. Na, da, 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 da. So I want to speak a little bit about the early days of the Freedom Center. First, there was one. There was Oryx. Then there were two. That was, then there were three. That was me, Dave. And then there were four. That was Vicky. And the four of us managed to join together and take on a $14 million mental health organization and have a major confrontation with them, nonviolent, that lasted for a matter of months or a year, lasted about a year, got their attention, got the attention of people all over the area, and ended up making, I believe, significant changes in the functioning of the organization. So I was one of four, and I've decided to call myself director of outreach of the four people. And my job was to hang out on the street in front of the cafes and connect with consumers and survivors. And find out what the word was on the street, and to meet people who had been diagnosed by psychiatry. So I did that for a period of time and got an idea of what the situation was for people in that classification. Then everything changed when a friend of mine was put into a residential treatment house. Very good friend of 15 years, who was a very good poet and a brilliant street performer. His best act was to recite Whitman in a loud voice and then to pretend to start taking off his pants. The police would be called and so forth, but they left him alone for a long time until one day he got a little too weird and he ended up living in this house and medicated. And I just was so upset I couldn't go there. Then a second friend was also a poet, was put in the same house. Because of my connection with the Freedom Center, I had the courage and the backup and the support to go to this place of horror and visit my friends. That's how it all started. Between 1970 and 1975, I had lived at R.D. Lang's experimental experiential communities in London. That was a world where psychotic, quotes, behavior was the norm, and normal, quotes, behavior was weird, to the extent that when I showed up, the fact that I'd been to Harvard was held against me, whereas the fact that I'd been diagnosed schizophrenic, they let me in immediately. And I was familiar with a whole range of human beings. So I started visiting the house in Northampton where the two poets were confined. As a visitor, I discovered there were two other people there that I knew, and I just started visiting. I was like the invisible man. I mean, if the residents were invisible, the residents' visitors were doubly invisible. And nobody really paid any attention to the fact that I was sitting around all the time. And I got to spend a lot of time in the house. It just came to pass that I found myself in the role of I became a secret agent for the Freedom Center. I had some extremely bizarre experiences where I'd be sitting in the corner of the room and I'd watch the nurse go through the prescribing and dosing ritual with a client right in front of me. And I could just kind of watch out of the corner of my eye, listen to the conversation. And everything the staff did, they did when I was there because I was less than invisible. It was like, and I spent quite a long period of time observing abusive behavior on the part of the staff toward the 10 residents of the house. The time they threw out somebody's medication in the dumpster, the times they called the police on people for no reason, the times they browbeat people into taking medication they didn't want, the times they overreacted to mildly angry behavior on the part of clients, as if they were the intimidation, brutalizing and dehumanizing atmosphere of the house. And I spent a long time there, and this was only possible because I was working with the Freedom Center, and I reported back, and I was the secret agent who reported the abuses. And I interviewed people in the house. I got to know everybody in the house, 10 people, and I would ask everybody, I would say, how did you first come to the attention of psychiatry? And I heard some amazing stories of people would tell me this. Everyone there, most of the people were forthcoming. There were a couple of people who were reticent. One guy never talked at all. He was the most reticent of all. There was a guy there who kept insisting that he liked his Haldol. He was very happy to be on Haldol, and he was. But there was the one day when he said that he wanted to get off it. And I realized that people who said they liked their medication didn't like it 100%. As is part of history now, this information was accumulated, turned into a series of letters to ServiceNet. This was the work of the other members of the group, and stuff in the media, stuff on the website, everything that happened. We've just celebrated the 5th year in business. If you've existed for 5 years, they figure you've made it. 5 years, that's it, like five. If you've existed for 5 years, they figure like you're gonna go on. I would like to mention one person. I'm not gonna mention any names, I guess. It was a woman in the house who was treated quite badly. She would invite me over for coffee a lot. She was treated quite badly. She would have something, some physical problem, and they would ignore it and pretend it was part of her mental condition. And they just didn't take her seriously. And we actually spoke on the phone to her mental health supervisor, who made us understand that they discredited everything she said. They didn't believe a word she said because she was mentally ill. Anyway, I won't mention her name, but I'd like to give a lot of credit to this one woman who was a major part of our movement and very much an activist in her own right. The second thing I want to talk about is probably the most important thing in my life right now. And it's inner work. It's very hard to explain what inner work is, even though we do it all the time. Every human being does inner work 24 hours a day. It's difficult to talk about. People who talk about doing inner work sound like some kind of spiritual heroes because extraordinary things happen. This is at Carl Jung, Arnold Mandel. People think, oh, these were spiritual giants, when they weren't. They were average human beings. But I'm going to take that risk, and I'm just going to talk about the inner work that I've done myself. I don't really know how. I have an idea of how to. I have been living for 35 years with a condition that I call Howard Hughes syndrome. Now, there's so many movies and books and stuff that people know that he was weird. So I share Howard Hughes's weirdness. This condition is known to psychiatry as obsessive compulsive disorder, 301.3 in the DSM or something. And after studying Carl Jung for many years and drinking and drugging as much as I possibly could to numb myself, in 1986 I decided to take the plunge. And I designed my life in a particular way. My first priority was not to drink or drug. My second priority was to do inner work, and I just lived that way for 10 or 12 years. And I was pretty much of a hermit. Howard Hughes syndrome is quite easy to do inner work with because it's easy to find the bad place. The way to do inner work, I believe, is to find the bad place and just go there. There is a story from mythology of a hunter who went to the castle and met the king and fell in love with a daughter, and the king said, "You can marry my daughter if you perform one task." And I'm leaving out details, but the hunter got on his horse and the dog was following, and he got to the lake. And a hand reached out of the lake, grabbed the dog, pulled it under the water, and the dog was never seen again. So the hunter on his horse at the edge of the lake, he said, "This must be the place." I tried to, instead of fleeing the contamination from obsessive compulsive, from Howard Hughes syndrome, I decided to approach it and to let whatever imagery came up fill my consciousness and to see if the contamination could manifest itself as a being, an animal, an insect, a human being, a god, I didn't care. And I got all those. I got insects, I got mammals, I got gods, and I spent this long period of time experiencing contamination as a being. And that was a major stage in my healing. Contamination was no longer a meaningless torment. It was a way of experiencing life. And even in that early stage, I had massive healing because I experienced my condition in a different way, and I was grateful for it because it gave me access to this inner world. I did this for a long time. I eventually connected with Arnold Mindell and the process work people out here in Oregon, started using their techniques, which revivified what I was doing. And my experience has been that doing inner work on Howard Hughes syndrome has made it tolerable, has made it a good life, and has made me grateful that I have this condition, because it's made my exploration of my inner world possible. So I feel lucky to be in this condition. And the symptoms don't necessarily go away real quick. They diminish. But I have 70% healing of Howard Hughes syndrome after these years of doing inner work. So I can't teach people how to do inner work. I've tried. But there are people out there who can teach it. The process work people in Portland can teach it. Fritz Perls could teach it. His disciples can teach it. There's people all over the country who can teach it. A lot of them charge a lot of money. There's a book by Arnold Mindell called Working on Yourself Alone. Is that right? Working on Yourself Alone by Arnold Mindell. It's the first book that I read by him, and I recommend it highly. And doing inner work is is just very simple. It's a matter of imagining anything and taking it from there. And I don't know why I have this image. I have this image of a banana. If I were to be trying to do inner work, I go to the dark place in my psyche, and I imagine a banana. And I observe what the banana does. Now, the banana might be squashed by a foot. The banana might explode. The banana might peel itself and reveal a delicious fruit inside. Somebody might eat the delicious fruit inside. Somebody might take the delicious fruit inside and smear it all over the wall. This is not really useful, but I'm trying my best. I can't teach people how to do inner work, but it's a flowing thing, and it's a matter of just imagining. Jung called this active imagination. It's where one imagines and then lives out the imagined life and discovers unknown parts of oneself. So I can't teach inner work, but I would encourage people to do it.